Good morning, everyone. You can turn to 1 Samuel chapter 18. That is the vicinity of the text that we'll start in. We'll look more closely at some latter chapters, but we're going to start overlapping a review right there. So good to see everyone this morning in continuing this study of the United Kingdom. Daryl, could you lead us in a prayer as we start, please?
I'll pray. Lord God, we thank you for this day. Thank you for your blessings and the opportunity to be here and study from your word. We pray that you'll be with Philip as he conducts the class, that you'll be with us as participants, and may we all be edified, and may we increase in knowledge and learn the things you would have us to. We pray for the other classes meeting today as well here, that you'll be with them in Christ's name. Amen.
So by the 18th chapter of 1 Samuel, what does Saul, king of Israel, first king of Israel, what does he see happening? He sees David as a threat, doesn't he? Now, what we have here are several chapters of this man coming unraveled, basically, Saul. And boy, it's bad when somebody becomes unraveled, but when they're a king, that's really tough, okay? Already we've seen that Saul, because of his disobedience to God, has a, quote, troubling spirit that comes upon him. It appears to be an occasional thing, but now we see an increasing instability in him, and you could almost call it a maddening instability. Regarding his outlook on things. He sees the kingdom slipping from his grasp, and his response is anger, desperation, violence. There is no lasting self-reflection. We'll see in a week or two some moments where Saul will have clarity about himself and about David, but they're short-lasting. Those moments of clarity don't change Saul. He continues on a downward spiral. And it's sort of sad to see happening. And he just cannot relate. He cannot embrace and allow it to affect him that things are progressing this way because of his own disobedience. Saul is common in that. Sorry, I'm teaching Saul right now in the Acts class. The other Saul, okay, in the New Testament. But Saul is very common in that blame everybody but yourself. That's how you make it. Blame everybody but yourself. Which Saul shows that's a recipe for disaster. And we're going to see the disaster of the next couple of chapters. So I appreciate Les filling in at fairly short notice last week because I had to be gone because of a death, a close friendship. But what we've seen here over the last little bit is that Saul is now attempting to try to kill David, though David is in his service. And we see this rage erupting, and textually we see two things connected to this in chapter 18. We see that David is rising in his view among the people, but preceding that, God had rejected him, and even Saul is aware that God has rejected him. So God rejecting Saul and David's rise in popularity is the mix that causes this rage that leads to this attempt to kill David. I don't know about you, but if somebody tried to kill me and they were my employer, I'd probably resign. David stays in Saul's service, even though Saul has these outbursts against him. It's really quite remarkable. And so he even puts David into what position? If you look there in chapter 18, verse 13, David's in what role? He's a captain or a commander in Saul's army. And he continues to have success, which means this thing only gets intensified regarding Saul's jealousy and his rage. The next thing that happens is that Saul decides to use Michal, his daughter, to do David in. We're not going to go into the details on that. You did that last week. But actually, a daughter was promised to the one who killed Goliath. Michal actually has been given to someone else already. But the way Saul decides to use Michael against him is to require the foreskins of 100 Philistines, which David supplies. And so Michael becomes his wife. Another thing, do you really want to marry into this family when your father-in-law is trying to kill you? I mean, it's a very strange thing. David's loyalty to Saul is incredible. And so David is so completely innocent in this whole situation. And then you have Jonathan advocating for David. So Jonathan goes to Saul and he advocates for David. And temporarily, Saul restores David to his presence and he backs off of David. But then the rage returns as David continues in his role, and Michael aids David, which enrages Saul even more. And so Michael had strong feelings for David, and she protects David and helps him to escape. And so this is about the place where you left off last week, I think. And what we see here, the next significant thing that happens in chapter 19, is that Jonathan attempts to mediate again between Saul and David. This is his father, Saul, but this is his beloved friend now. They have a friendship, a non-blood, brotherly love for one another that is very, very intense. And I want you to look with me in chapter 20. And look at the end of chapter 20, verse 3. David and Jonathan are talking. This is after Saul's tried to kill him several times. This is after he's tried to capture him, and Michael helps him to escape. And look at the statement at the end of 20, verse 3. How does David describe his situation? I'm just one step away from death. I don't think we're to see this as some kind of overreaction. It's important. It's really interesting, and this is sort of a theme in today's study, that we've got this perspective of God unfolding these events. However, in the moment, David can't see all this. And so it's important for us to feel what David's feeling. David feels truly threatened. Because what would the typical human person, let me give you the scenario before we even get to the cave. The typical human successful commander who has got the people behind him and the king is starting to become unhinged, what does the typical up-and-coming great commander do? A coup d'etat. Let's just go ahead and take this king out. I'm your man now. That's exactly how it's happened thousands and thousands and thousands of times through history. But David's loyalty to Saul is unconditional. He is not going to strike him. He's not going to rebel against him. And so he feels vulnerable. That's why people lash out and fight, because they're scared. They feel vulnerable. So they got to fight back. David can't fight back. He's not going to do that. So he is feeling incredibly vulnerable. And he expresses that to Jonathan. She had something else, Rick?
Yeah, a couple things. The one I just thought of was that it appears David's loyalty is not to Saul necessarily as a person.
It's the principle.
But to Saul as God's anointed to that office. And he actually brings that up, you know, down the road. And another thing that you inferred, but I don't think you actually ever said it, was that, you know, asking for 100 foreskins of the Philistine is a precarious situation. He's putting him in danger, maybe even as the commander of the army, he's putting him in danger intentionally. We see that happen with David, even, and you're right.
That's how he tries to destroy David through Michael. You want my daughter? Put yourself in harm's way with the Philistines. So David does it, and he's successful. So that doesn't work. It backfires. And so... but yeah, ultimately we see what's motivating David, as it always does, God, what God wants him to do. But Jonathan, even when he makes the case here in a moment again to Saul, Jonathan makes the case, he's been nothing but loyal to you, Father. And he has.
The fact that David has been anointed by Samuel as king, that there's a certain confidence that he has in his destiny, that he's almost, well, yes, he's worried about, obviously he's fleeing from Saul, but at the same time, I wonder if he knows that ultimately he can't be killed because God is already anointed and killed.
Okay, you have uncovered a very common human dilemma. There's what we know to be true, but there's the emotion that we're feeling in the moment. Yes, he knows what Samuel did to him. He's got to understand intellectually he's destined to be king. But he's feeling very threatened. How many times do we, right, we know something, but then we feel something different. So that's the dilemma that we have as humans. So that's David's state. So that Saul would not be tipped off. So they're starting now. Jonathan and David both are starting to carefully, diplomatically deal with Saul. And so that Saul would not be tipped off, Jonathan has a plan to find out his father's feelings now, to fill him out. And it has to do with David showing up for a feast. We're having to do a flyover in these chapters and not a detailed examination. But David's supposed to show up for a feast. He does not. And so they're waiting to see how Saul reacts to that. Does he react with rage or does he react with understanding and all that? So as they're planning it, I want you to look there. And this has to do with that destiny aspect. Look in chapter 20. Let's go ahead and read chapter 20, verse 13 to 17, please.
May the Lord do so and much more to Jonathan. But if it pleases my father to do you evil, that I will report it to you and send you away, that you may go in safety, and the Lord be with you, as he has been with my father. And you shall not only show me kindness, me the kindness of the Lord while I still live, that I may not die, but you shall not cut off your kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, let the Lord require it at the hand of David's enemy. Now Jonathan again caused David to vow because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul.
So even with Jonathan, what kind of sense or expectation does Jonathan have about David in the future?
Knows God's with David, and that's going to continue to propel David upward.
Exactly. He knows that God is going to give victory to David ultimately over his enemies, which is what he's saying in so many words is, you're going to end up on top in this. You're going to be king. I mean, he'll say that later on. And so see what's developing in Jonathan's own thinking, which is ironic because Jonathan is, okay, he is killed. I'm sorry. What's his position in Israel? Son of the king, which means one day, because we don't read of any other notable son of Saul. So according to the text, Jonathan should be next up. But Jonathan believes that David is next up. You see that? And it doesn't trouble him. So this is an incredible character, Jonathan. It's so easy to miss Jonathan in this conflict between Saul and David, but he's a marvelous character. He's got an incredible outlook on things. Boy, if you could have a friend like Jonathan. So may all your friends be like a Jonathan, put it that way. So sure enough, they have the feast. Saul is suspicious of David not being there by the second day. And so he begins to drill Jonathan, and Jonathan stands to defend David. So look at chapter 20. Ken, could you read verse 30 to 34?
Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your king nor your kingdom shall be established. Therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. Then Jonathan answered Saul, his father, why should he be put to death? What has he done? But Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him. So Jonathan knew that his father was determined to put David to death. And Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had disgraced him.
So now, what has Saul's jealous outrage toward David resulted in? And before he tries to kill his son, he is dressing him down with terrible language. This ugly language toward Jonathan, even about Jonathan's mother. It's the old adage, right? Start insulting somebody's mother. That's what he's doing here. And then Jonathan advocates for David. He's been loyal. And then Saul tries to kill him. And this is just an ugly situation getting uglier by the moment, it seems like. And so Jonathan gives the signal to David that, no, his father is not going to receive David now. It's sort of a little complicated little signal they have. But it appears when you're reading the text that they have this signal so Jonathan and David wouldn't be seen together. But then they are seen together. And there is this farewell that they issue to one another at the end of chapter 20. And you would think this would be the last time they see each other. But think about it. David said at the beginning of the chapter, there's but one step between me and death. They don't know when a goodbye is the last goodbye. However, this is not the last time they see each other. They will again. But look what it says here. Ken, again, chapter 20, verse 41 and 42. And look what they say to one another.
And as soon as the boy had gone, David rose from beside the stone heap and fell on his face to the ground and bowed three times. And they kissed one another and wept with one another, David weeping the most. Then Jonathan said to David, go in peace, because we have sworn, both of us, in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord shall be between me and you, and between my offspring and your offspring forever. And he rose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city.
So thank you. You noted there, back when Jonathan left the presence of his father, was driven from the presence of his father because his father is throwing a spear at him, that it says that he was fiercely angry. When he meets up with David and they embrace, it says at the end of verse 41 that who is the most emotional? David is weeping the most. The text tells us David's weeping the most. Jonathan has anger in this moment and is more composed when he interacts with David. It's David's heart that's breaking more for this situation because he understands the situation that Jonathan is in. Because it's not just David who is in a precarious situation. It's now Jonathan in a precarious situation because his father's turned on him. I want you to watch for, it's subtle, somewhat subtle until you see it, and it's not, and we'll see another example of it, how very unselfish David is. He's a very unselfish person. So, we have an idea now how Jonathan views this situation and how he's behaving in this situation. So, what is Jonathan thinking? Jonathan has a sense, he has a bearing about him. What do you make of it? How he understands things and interprets things. If you go back in chapter 20, and this is what Daryl was commenting on in verse 14, 15. Jonathan was aware that God was with David. What's driving Jonathan's perspective is God. Is Jonathan seeing this thing right? Absolutely. You know how hard that is? It's his father. He's the prince. But Jonathan is incredibly objective how he sees this thing. 90% of the people aren't objective about their family. Jonathan is. He's a very rare person. I think David struggles with that later on, being really objective about his family. Even somebody like David struggles with it. And he has this immense care for David. He's trying to help David, protect David, advocate for David. And he has a clear understanding of his father. He sees his father as what? Basically, when he talks to his father before, at the court, before the spear is hurled at him, how does he see Saul's handling of this?
Wrong.
You've got it all wrong about David. He's telling his son, Saul is, don't you understand? You're not even safe. If David's around, you're not safe. You need to bring him to me and we execute him. Jonathan doesn't see David as a threat. And Jonathan's like, no, Father, you've got it wrong. He's loyal to you. He's not a threat. And so, you know, a lot of people have offended God and they're wrong with God and they take it out on some human being. It's really God they've got the problem with. Saul's problem's with God because he's been so blatantly disobedient. But yet, he's trying to, you know, divert this. He's trying to make David the issue. And David's not the issue. Saul's disobedience is the issue here. And Jonathan, in a marvelous way, navigates all this so accurately. So accurately. And I think the thing that underlies his perspective on things is that he's a man of faith. And he sees what God is doing here. He understands that. Okay, anything else on chapter 20? We're just hitting the peaks here. So, starting in chapter 21, we see that David is truly on the lam. I mean, in 18, 19, and 20, there is this. He's on the bubble. Can he come back to Saul or not come back to Saul? And Saul's trying to kill him, but then Saul takes him back. And is there a chance that Saul's going to take him back into the court? That's all over now. He's actually on the lam, which is our modern expression for he is like someone who's being chased by the authorities and he's on the run. Now, you can be innocent or guilty and be on the lam. David is innocent. So, he comes to this place here called Nob in chapter 21. We're just going to summarize this. And there is a priest there. There's a collection of priests there. But there is a notable priest there that he interacts with by the name of Ahimelech, with an H, Ahimelech. And Ahimelech, David does not tell him what's going on. He holds that back. Because this is such a bizarre situation. You know the best thing to do when you're in a bizarre situation? Don't try to explain it to people. Because it's too bizarre for them to get it. Need to know. So David is on the lam. He needs help. Ahimelech gives him food and a weapon. Evidently, David's got some men with him. He is a commander, right? So Ahimelech helps David, and then David moves on, and David ends up in this chapter 21 taking refuge in Gath, which is a city among the Philistines. Okay, at this point, who were the Philistines in regards to Israel? Their mortal enemy. Remember who David killed? He was the champion of the Philistines. Goliath was.
Gath as well.
Do
I? I think he may have been from Gath.
May have been. There are like five or six leading Philistine cities, and Gath is one of them.
I feel like there's something that said that.
It may be. I can't recall. But he goes in among the Philistines. And I want you to see this. He doesn't go over to the enemy. He's looking for a safe haven. And David is a righteous, godly, unselfish man. But he's shrewd. In a good way, he's cunning. He's harmless as a dove, as Jesus would say, but he's wise as a serpent. Would you agree with that? David is harmless as a dove and wise as a serpent. After all, in so many ways, David is the prototype of the Messiah, more than any other character in the Old Testament. And so he goes, the last place Saul would think to look, and the last place where he could look, right? He's not going to come to the Philistines and say, hey, I need to look for David among you. That's not going to happen. And so this is how desperate this situation is. This is where he has to go. And this is how messed up the situation is. And so I want you to comprehend this as a reader of the text. It looks like, by the time David gets to the Philistines, it looks like this whole thing is spinning out of control. What? David, who killed Goliath, is taking refuge among the Philistines? This looks so out of control. The reality is, it's not out of control at all. There are a lot of ways in which this works to a positive. He understands what the Philistines are doing and all those kinds of things. It sort of discombobulates them a little bit. They don't know whether to trust him or not. I would have you see that this is unfolding exactly the way God planned it to unfold. Does that not tell us a lot? He knows where that road is going, though we don't. We can't see around the bend, but he does. And it may look like things are out of control, but it's not with God. It's unfolding as he wills. So, as he's on the lam, note this, because this helps to prepare things into the future. Look at chapter 22. Jesse, can you read verse 1 and 2? It's not just David on the run. 22, 1 and 2.
David therefore departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. So when his brothers and all his father's house heard of it, they went down there to him. And everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontent gathered to him. So he became captain over them, and there were about 400 men with him.
All right, thank you. You think 400 men is a sizable, powerful source? Force? Okay, yeah, it's better than zero. It's 100 more than Gideon. That's not a sizable force, okay? But it is a start, and that's not how David's going to become king. He's not going to become king because of military tactics, strategy. God's going to put him in place. But he does have this following, and the following is of whom?
The outcast.
And think about this. Just pause for a moment. What kind of confidence do you have in Saul being king at this point? What kind of administrator do you think he is at this point? He's what?
His judgment's clearly clouded.
Okay. It's so clouded because what's he fixated on?
David.
He's obsessed, a leader who's obsessed with enemies, okay? He's blind. He doesn't make a good administrator. He's on one track. And so it's not unusual then for there to be people who felt like they were being treated unjustly. It talks about people in debt. There are different ways why people become in debt. Most of the time in modern times, it's not a good thing, okay? In ancient times, there could be some things that could happen, no fault of your own, that you're in troublesome debt. And so debt oftentimes, and still is, it's a predatory thing. People use it to take advantage of you. And so there are some people here who quite could be treated unjustly and have a legitimate beef. Because what kind of ruler would we expect this man to be at this point? Not a good one. And so that tells us something. It's a crack in his reign. It's another crack in his reign. It's what we've got here. Yeah.
I've always thought verse 2 is somewhat typical of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it is a prototype of the Messiah. Again, the people he called.
Come to him or the outcast.
That's exactly. I think it is so messianic, Rick. Exactly right. There's more in there than we can even see, probably, about David and the Christ. Incredible. So then, if you think trying to kill your own son is the bottom. Then we come to chapter 22. Because David is on the lam with the help of Ahimelech, who Ahimelech has no idea that he helped him, how he helped him exactly, the situation. But Saul finds out that Ahimelech and these priests have aided David. Okay, so let's look here at this. Rick, will you read 22 verse 9? I want you to read all the way down to verse 19.
Then Doeg the Edomite, who was standing by the servants of Saul, answered and said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech the son of Ahitub. And he inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Then the king sent someone to summon Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's household, the priests who were in Nob, and all of them came to the king. And Saul said, Listen now, son of Ahitub. And he answered, Here I am, my lord. Saul then said to him, Why have you and the son of Jesse conspired against me, and that you have given him bread and a sword, and has inquired of God for him, that he should rise up against me by lying in ambush as it is this day? Then Ahimelech answered the king and said, And who among all your servants is as faithful as David, even the king's son-in-law, who is captain over your guard and is honored in your house? Did I just begin to inquire of God for him today? Far be it from me. Do not let the king impute anything to his servant or to any of the household of my father, for your servant knows nothing at all of this whole affair. But the king said, You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's household. And the king said to the guards who were attending him, Turn around and put the priest of the Lord to death, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew that he was fleeing and did not reveal it to me. But the servants of the king were not willing to put forth their hands to attack the priest of the Lord. Then the king said to Doeg, You turn around and attack the priest. And Doeg the Edomite turned around and attacked the priest, and he killed that day 85 men who wore the linen ephod. And he struck Nob, the city of the priests, with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children, infants, and oxen, donkeys, and sheep. He struck with the edge of the sword.
All right. Thank you. There's a point made in chapter 21 when David interacts with Ahimelech and gets the sword. And here in chapter 22 that the sword was Goliath's sword that David had taken from him when he slayed him. And evidently had been in storage here with these priests. The fact that David has that sword is very symbolic, right? Because that was when David emerged as this great champion and the people started to rally around him. And Saul interrogates the priests, and legitimately, they have no idea what's going on. But can you reason with Saul? You can't reason with this man. He's obsessed. And so Saul orders what? Death of the priests. And it's so outrageous that his soldiers, what? They refuse to do it. But there's somebody handy who had been witness to David interacting with Ahimelech. He's the opportunistic, dastardly doer of wicked deeds, Doeg. I'll say that again if you want to write it down. He's a nasty character. He's nasty. Why does Doeg do this? Personal gain. It gets him in favor with Saul.
He's not.
Yeah, he's not. And he's betting on the wrong horse, so to speak. He's jumping on the wrong ship at the wrong time. And he's doing it in the worst way. So Doeg carries out the first deed, and then there is this punishment to the whole community, and death is slaying the whole community. What is this saying about Saul? So the priest, doing this to the priest, and these appear to be not corrupt priests like we find in the New Testament, the high priests that were corrupt, the lower priests not so much. But these are seen as legitimate priests, and they're innocent in this. They're trying to do the right thing, and the priests had the role of mediators between Israel and God. They brought the worship to God for the people, and they brought the law to the people from God. Saul is severing that. He's already severed his relationship with God. He's trying to sever a relationship between Israel and God by eradicating the priest. And I think that's a great word, complete irreverence for God in this. He has completely lost it. Yeah, Jesse.
Something the priest points out, but Saul does not even, he just ignores his left. I didn't even know what David was doing. I didn't even know he was there. Yeah. I thought he was there on your orders.
Right.
Yeah. He's completely innocent in this. And he's unhinged and has no regard for God's order of things. Now, there are so many ways already in these texts that this is happening. And I think this is quite, it jumps out at you in a way. And that is the contrast between Saul and David. The text then immediately goes to David hearing about this. Okay? Joe, could you read 1 Samuel 22, verse 20 to 23?
But one son of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priest of the Lord. Then David said to Abiathar, I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have brought about the death of every person in your father's household. Stay with me, do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life, for you are safe with me.
All right.
While Saul consistently perceives things wrongly, like what David is doing, what Jonathan is doing, he's reading everybody the wrong way. David is very perceptive. And he knew when that Edomite was there, that Doeg the Edomite was there, he knew that was not going to turn out well. And David even feels and takes on a sense of what?
Responsibility
for what happened. What's David's occupation originally? Do you see how he's operating as a shepherd? He feels responsible for people. Even when he's not guilty of what happened to him, he feels a sense of responsibility. Saul is the one slaying people. David is feeling responsible. See the contrast between Saul and David? And what a heart of a shepherd that David manifests here. Because that's what David will be. He will be the shepherd king of Israel. Joe, do you have something?
I mean, I guess David didn't really tell the truth when he told him that he had been sent there, you know. I had a Bible school class one time when I was a young Christian about the lie and how this ended up getting all these guys killed. David wasn't telling the truth. Saul didn't send him there. And also, on top of that, but God had marked Eli's children to be killed anyway, right? I mean, Ahimelech was descended from Eli, right?
Well, I think the only, just have to go back and look, the only prophecy God made through Samuel was that Eli's sons, I don't think it was meant perpetually, okay? Yeah, Hophni and Phinehas. This is a tough area. I can't say David lied in this situation. He says, I'm on king's business. There's a lot of ways in which that is absolutely true. Who's the real king in Israel? I know you may say, well, that's a little, you know, sly. And besides that, who is actually going to be, and in God's eyes, who's God's king? David is. David is trying to protect himself. Okay? And he said, I'm on the king's business. Now, I know that somebody can say, well, you know how Ahimelech would have taken that. And he does take it that way. But, I don't know. It's a tough situation. I don't think, you know, listen, we could argue an hour on this. I don't want to do it.
I think it goes to a point I was making a couple weeks ago about Bible class.
It's Rahab's situation.
These people are imperfect.
It's the Rahab situation. It's the Hebrew midwife situation in Exodus 2. Okay, I'm going to move on. Okay, out of time. Got to get to one more chapter here. Chapter 23. So, in chapter 23, what we have, once you look at the end of the chapter with me, is that in chapter 23, David meets up with Jonathan again. And at verse 18, and the two of them made a covenant before the Lord. David remained at Horesh and Jonathan went home. They keep promising. This is like three times. They keep promising to be loyal to one another and implying that perpetually into the future with their descendants, there will be this honorable treatment of one another. Because think about it. On the surface, David and Jonathan could have ended up enemies in this situation. Jonathan could have had should have had the throne, right? According to man's ways. And I want you to see that Jonathan, to his dying day, is loyal to David. And David, even after Jonathan's death, is loyal to this friendship. They make this promise here, and they keep it. I want you to see that. David, even after Jonathan's death, is loyal to him and his family, taking care of them. So, look at verse 19 and 20. The Ziphites went up to Saul at Gibeah, saying, "Is not David hiding among us in the strongholds at Horesh on the hill of Keilah, which is south of Jeshimon? Now come down, O king, according to all your heart's desire to come down, and our part shall be to surrender him into the king's hand." So some locals hear that David's in their territory, and so they say, "Come, king, and we'll hand him over to you. We'll help you apprehend this David." So the locals side with Saul and promise to deliver him. And what you see in this moment, it's not looking for good for David. He's got people working against him here, trying to get in Saul's good graces. And then chapter 23, verse 25, "And Saul and his men went to seek him, and David was told. So he went down to the rock and lived in the wilderness of Maon. And when Saul heard that, he pursued after David in the wilderness of Maon." Do you see the trajectory here? It's like wherever David goes, Saul is on his trail. He's on his heels. Saul went on one side of the mountain, and David and his men on the other side of the mountain. Well, that's close. And David was hurrying to get away from Saul. Do you see that moment? He's in peril here. Saul's about to apprehend him. As Saul and his men were closing in on David and his men to capture them. Now let's believe the text. David's about to be captured. His back's against the wall. He has no way out. A messenger came to Saul saying, "Hurry and come, for the Philistines have made a raid against the land." See, how good of a king is Saul at this point? You see, he's a terrible king. He's allowed the Philistines to threaten the land because he's been so obsessed with David. So Saul returned from pursuing after David and went against the Philistines. Therefore, that place was called the Rock of Escape, and David went up from there and lived in the strongholds of En-Gedi. Saul's got tremendous resources as king. He's got people helping him. David is limited regarding his resources. And David is running out of room. But yet, still, Saul is unable to what? Unable to capture him. And you know what's going to happen. He will execute him if he captures him. Why? Why can't Saul catch him? Why is he so frustrated in this mission? Because God. God's helping him. No matter how these events appear to be out of control and working against David, the reality is it's not working against David. God's in control, and God is ultimately protecting David, and David will be king one day. And so it's just that providence is always on the side of the faithful. Always on the side of the faithful. It's just that providence is something that we don't have the script for. We don't have the map of God's providence. What we have is faith that God will work it out. And so, boy, he is about to get him here. But he has to run back to protect the land, because if he gets David and loses Israel, there's no gain there, right? So God is protecting David. And, you know, Saul's at a juncture here. But he always chooses to double down on his rage and his determination to destroy David. And that will be his undoing. Yeah.
Just thinking of a parallel between David and Jesus. Like, human beings could not have killed Jesus before God's timing.
Right.
And they couldn't have killed David before God's time.
Right.
And then even after killing Jesus and thinking that they have eradicated the problem, he conquers death. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much. And that's great to see Jesus in this. Thank you so much.